Succession number 28897, Reel 5.
This is the third reel of a taped interview with George Oliver in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 3rd of the 2nd, 2006, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. George, you obviously talked about arriving in England, and you mentioned this chap who sort of held his hat to his heart and did a sort of sign of thanks.
Yes, well, that's what we took it as. I'm sure it was, yes. Mm. And,
was that a general impression you got from the locals in England?
Well, they made us welcome, so I could just say they didn't go to that extent, but they certainly were hospitable, and we must have got on this train, and we went up to Bournemouth. There was a big holding camp at Bournemouth, and so we stayed in a hotel there. Can't remember the name, but one thing I do remember is that, and I'm not sure certain that I don't get Brighton and Bournemouth mixed up sometimes, but the hotel had these rope lifts, that, and I might have mentioned that in Brighton, because I'm not sure whether it was Brighton or Bournemouth. At any rate, Bournemouth, of course, is a very nice coastal town on the south coast, and I think there were a lot of retired people there, and I don't know whether they still are, but it seemed to be a place where there were a lot of retired people, and there were all sorts of people there, mainly Australians. I think there were some New Zealanders there. I don't know about Canadians, but there was certainly a lot of Australian airmen who'd been posted over to the UK, and I had a spell in hospital. I developed some boils and carbuncles and things on the ship on the way over, and they put me in hospital for a while and tried to clear them up. And while I was in that hospital, some of our lads went off on some sort of a commando type course up north somewhere. And of course, we'd be pretty soft after hanging around on a ship for 6 weeks or whatever. Oh, it was more than 6 weeks. It was a few months, wasn't it?
Well, Ron Minchin talks about this commando course.
Does he?
So you got out of it, I presume.
Yeah, I did. When they got back, I thought, well, I'm just as happy I was out of that. Didn't sound like my cup of tea. But, yes, Ron would have gone. I think most of them went. And I think it was, as much as anything, it was to keep them occupied, you know. And but we had parades regularly there, and yes, that's right. This was where the Germans came over and dropped the bomb on a parade ground one day, but one day that I know of, at any rate. And it was a Sunday, so we didn't parade on Sunday, so there was no one on the parade ground. I don't know whether they were being chivalrous about that or not, that they chose Sunday. But at any rate, there must have been more than one bomb, because one of them damaged the local pub where we used to go for a drink of beer and whatnot. And
well, must have been a nuisance to you.
Yes, it wasn't received very well. We didn't mind them messing up our parade ground, but we didn't go much on that, messing up our favourite pub. Apart from that, I don't remember a lot about Bournemouth. A family called Newman invited me to their premises. I think it was called West Harrow now. But anyway, it was somewhere in the vicinity of Bournemouth, and Mrs. Newman came in, and I don't remember all the details, but I do remember being on a train with Mrs. Newman. I might have got a bit ahead of myself here. I think before we went to Bournemouth, we went up to London. And a senior Royal Air Force officer came and had a talk to us and thanked us for coming over too. And I've got a feeling that Mrs. Newman may have picked me up in London, and that's how I came to be on the train with her. And I'm sure she did now. And took us down to her, and she was the first one to introduce me to the English countryside. So again, just then it was in winter mode, more or less, and I think the buds were just starting to break, you know, and she was telling me how different it is in the spring and autumn and summer from what it is in Australia. Mm. And So that was quite interesting. And she
what
told
were your general impressions of Britain?
Well, at the time, well, I don't know about at the time. I was just that curious. I noticed the trees all there. Well, of course, we've got evergreen trees here. So I noticed that difference. And there was a fair bit of snow around, and we don't have any snow. So I was very curious. But my long-term view of the UK countryside is that it's very nice. You know, it's a nice green and pleasant land. I can accept that.
People obviously talk of England as home. Did you have any sort of sense of this place being
no,
an important place?
No, not personally, but some of our friends did. In where I grew up in Victoria Park, Mrs. Brown over the road used to refer to home, and we had some Scottish people up the road too that referred to home. A lot of that generation did. Of course, a lot of them were born there too, but yes, they used to refer to it as home. Tell us the tea wasn't any good here, like couldn't get tea like you got in England, things like that. Which might have been true too, because I don't know where we've got our tea from.
Mm. What was the general atmosphere in Britain at the time of your arrival? The general feeling in the air, given what was going on?
I think they were pretty worried, really. You know, there hadn't been much good news at that time. This is 1943. There'd been a lot of disasters, hadn't there? And I think they were pretty worried. And I think, of course, the Americans and the Russians also came up against Germany, so I suppose well, Churchill certainly was always anxious to get the Americans into it, and I think once that happened, they might not have been so worried, but I got the impression that they were still pretty worried then.
What was your general knowledge of your future? Had anyone told you what your future would entail now that you were in Britain?
Well, I'm not sure where this happened. No, it probably happened at Bournemouth. Because I was called up to an interview and asked what sort of job I would like to do. And I said I'd like to fly bombers. I don't think it would have made much difference if I'd said I wanted to fly fighters, but at any rate, I didn't think I had the natural aggressiveness to fight. Well, I was thinking in terms of Battle of Britain fighters, you know, not fighter bombers that were strafing and so forth later on. I just thought, well, bombers seem to be the goer, and I think they were the sort of people they wanted, were bomber people mainly. But I don't know where that was. I did get into trouble a bit there, and Mum had sent me a roll neck sweater made out of West Australian wool, of course, and through the comfort funds. And I wore this into the interview. And the officer ticked me off and asked me whether I thought I was a Battle of Britain pilot. He said, they wear them, but you're not going to wear them. You wear a collar and tie.
What was the reputation of the Battle of Britain pilots?
Pardon?
What was the reputation of the Battle of Britain pilots?
Oh, it was very good. Very good. Yes. Yes, they did a good job. I don't think anyone can deny that. Of course, the British radar was a big aid to them that the Germans didn't have. So I think that helped a lot too, but it wouldn't detract from the bravery and the aggression of the pilots.
Were there particular pilots that you knew that you looked up to, given their reputation, given their experience?
No, I don't think at that stage there were. I didn't know anything about the individual pilots, I don't think. I might have heard of Douglas Bader, probably. Of course, you know the story of him, a legless pilot. Crashed before the war, I think it was, and lost his legs and flew around with these tin legs. Eventually got shot down and captured. And
They flew his legs to him, yes.
That was a bit of romance, wasn't it?
In relation to being a pilot now, what was the actual feeling like? Being in Britain, having come from Australia, preparing to do what you've been trained for?
Well, I suppose we were a bit apprehensive to some extent, but we were pretty keen to get back flying again too. And my first job was a refresher course on tiger moths. They sent me to a place called Cliff Pippard, which isn't too far from what's the big railway junction there near London? I know it well enough, but I just can't think of it. I did a few trips and a few flights in a tiger moth under an instructor, because the rules might have been different in the UK from what they were here. And one of the things I do remember, one of my first impressions, you asked me about the countryside. Well, when I got up there and tried to map read, I was absolutely stonkered, because in Australia here, if you saw a railway line in Western Australia or a road and you could see the direction of it, you had a pretty good idea where it was going and so forth. But when I got up in the air in England and looked down, there seemed to be villages everywhere, and they all looked the same to me pretty well, and railway lines going all over the place and roads going all over the place. And I think some of the instructors were a bit hard on some of us for that reason. It was quite difficult to map read at first in the different situation. But we got around it in the end, and managed to map read all right. And on the job I got in the end, you had to be able to map read quite well. So that was that, and then my next posting was to Advanced Flying School, where we flew Oxford, Airspeed Oxfords. And this was a pretty intense sort of a course. We had to do lots of exercises in these Oxfords. One of them was what we called beacon bashing. All over the UK there were these beacons flashing a couple of letters. They were dotted all over the UK there, or some of it anyhow. And our job was to go up on our own in these Oxfords and work out some courses to the various beacons and fly around them. This is at night as a rule, obviously. And beacon bashing was quite good for your flying, and you had to fly at a certain speed on a certain course to get to the beacon. And it was good training for us, and then you had to read the letters that came up so you knew which beacon it was, and that's where our Morse code started to come forth, you know. And that was one exercise. We did cross countries as well, lots of circuits and landings, both night and day, instrument flying. And we also did a beam approach course where you had to fly under the hood with an instructor and had to learn to measure the beam to find out whether you were on the back beam or the front beam. We did that with a stopwatch by crossing the beam and measuring the time it took to cross it, and then turning on the heading of the beam and flying along, and then flying it across again and timing it. And if it was narrower the second time or quicker the second time to get across, we knew we were on the front beam. And if it was wider, we knew we were on the back beam. So then you had to get on the beam, and there was a constant note in the centre of the beam heading towards the aerodrome, and there was dit-dit on one side and da-da on the other side, and you had to keep on the constant note. And of course, as the beam approached the drone, it got narrower and narrower, and then you picked up an outer marker beacon, and I think that was at 1,000 feet, and from the outer marker beacon you descended at a definite rate of descent and a definite airspeed, so that you could get to the inner marker beacon just at the end of the runway. And you did all this, took about over an hour and a half, I think, altogether, these trips, and with an instructor in, but all you could see was your instrument panel. So with that and the link trainer, we ended up to be pretty good instrument flyers. Mm. Yes, yeah, so they really did train us well. And
What was life on the base like?
Life on the base like? Well, we made a lot of good mates. On one occasion, an English pilot and I became very matey because we were both motorbike fans when we were young. And we used to go off and have a meal in one of the roadhouse cafes, where if you didn't ask for what you wanted, you just said, we'll have whatever's on tonight. And sometimes, if you were lucky, you might have got a bit of bacon and an egg or something.
You're lucky you might get something you liked.
Yeah. Yes, that's another thing. It was just a hit and miss sort of thing, but we used to enjoy it. Of course, that would only be on nights when the flying was cancelled, and that didn't happen that often. We were very good mates, but when we parted from advanced flying, I didn't hear of him ever again. So I don't know what happened to him.
Well, people talk of this scenario where you did make good friends. You had lots in common with people, but you were on a lot of occasions. It was a bit risky to make too close a friend because they might not come back from a flight one day.
Yes, well, you see, it's difficult in peacetime to describe the attitude, the mental attitude under war conditions. You might have had the best mate in the world and go around with him like I was with this chap, but you didn't really, you knew you had to part, and you were psyched up to this sort of thing more, you know. You didn't develop any great sentiment, I don't think. And also there was so much going on around you where people were losing their lives and taking risks, that it didn't seem so traumatic as what it does in peacetime, you know. And I think you've got a different mindset, and that's something that you can't describe to other people despite your trying. And all my mates have said the same thing. They just find very much difficulty in describing their feelings.
What were your impressions when you experienced things like being bombed for the first time?
Well, I was never actually in a... I was never ever bombed. The nearest I got to being bombed was when we were in Buzz Bomb Alley later on in the war.
But you mentioned earlier on that your parade ground had been bombed.
Oh, yes. I wasn't there then.
But you've been sort of experienced the closeness of these bombings.
Oh,
what
yeah.
was that like to know that you're actually in a war zone?
Well, it was a bit worrying, of course, yes. But when all the civilians and everybody was in the same boat, it didn't seem quite as singular.
So here you are, learning to fly by instrument.
Mm.
Did you know what planes you would end up flying?
No. No. When I finished advanced flying, they posted me to operational training unit. An operational training unit. And I had to fly Wellingtons there. And
what were they like to fly?
I didn't like them that much, to tell you the truth. They were a bit heavy on the approach and the takeoff, and I didn't like them after the Oxford. The Oxford was nippy and manoeuvrable. But, of course, these were a much bigger aircraft, and they were an operational aircraft at that time, even though they were being outdated fairly quickly. But and we had to pick up a crew. This is where we first joined up as a crew. When we got to the station after settling in and everything, we were taken to a big, I suppose it was a hangar or some fairly big space, and we met lots of other blokes, and they had all been trained in different trades: wireless operators, gunners, navigators, bomb aimers and such, you see. And they just sent all we pilots in there, and there were all these chaps, and they said, okay, get yourself a crew. That's the way the Royal Air Force did it. And I thought, gosh, I don't know if this will work. Who's going to come and fly with me? But at any rate, some Scotsman came up and said, I want an Aussie pilot. I don't know why he wanted an Aussie pilot. We fell out later on in the war, but at any rate, he got one. And he had a friend who happened to be trained as a gunner, and so he came over and said, you know, I'd like an Aussie pilot, how about it? And I said, okay, we'll join up. And then he said, well, I've got a mate over there that's a gunner. I said, oh, well, bring him over. And then I saw an Australian wireless operator, because we had these dark blue uniforms, and I went over to him and I said, George Oliver, and he said, oh, I'm Les Steele. I said, where are you from, Les? He said, Perth, Western Australia. So I invited Les to join the crew, and he flew with me until we were separated after we'd finished our operations, and he came out here. No, I knew him after the war, but Les died a long time ago now. And then we had a Canadian bomb aimer. I'm not too sure how we got him. I think one of the ones that had already been joined us pointed him out, and he knew a couple of the Canadian gunners, and we ended up with two of those at that stage. So we had a mixture of English, Scottish, Australian and Canadian in our crew.
Was there a reputation that these different nationalities held? How were the Canadians seen? How were the Tommies seen? And how were the Australians seen?
Well, I don't really know. I hope we had a reasonable reputation, I think it was there was mutual respect all round. I mean, you were going to be in this aluminium can and fly around the place, and some of it was very dangerous. So we didn't really think much about our nationality. One thing that it did prove to my satisfaction was that we're all the same underneath, but we had grown up in different environments and we've got different attitudes to life, but we had that in common, that we had to work as a team, and I think mutual respect would be the time. And some people might have been prejudiced against others, but I didn't have any feelings that way. I just accepted people at face value, which I think is a bit of a trait with Australians, really, to do that, more so than perhaps some other nationalities.
Well, let's talk about the continued training, presumably, once you'd obtained...
Well, first of all, I had to learn to fly the Wellington. And
what was involved with that? Describe learning to fly a Wellington bomber.
Well, first of all, we had to do some ground subjects. Always we had to do ground subjects. And you had to learn quite a bit about the hydraulic systems and the electrical systems and the fuel systems and that sort of thing. And some of this was written tests and so forth. And then you had to learn the cockpit drill for each aircraft, all the procedures that you had to go through before you could get airborne. And so all that had to be done, and then you went out with an instructor and taxied it around for a while. I don't know whether I took off the first time under the instructors. I think you did, because we were all qualified pilots. And we just took off and did some circuits and bumps for a start to get the feel of the aircraft. And he advised us on... The controls are always a bit different, you see, and he had advised us on the various eccentricities of the aircraft, if it had any, and took us up, and after a few couple of days or so, usually we were sent solo. And then I was a bit apprehensive then, not because I was going to fly solo, but because I was going to take this crew of seven other blokes up, you see. And I didn't know what they were going to think of me. And so...
Well, presumably there's a lot of responsibility being the pilot.
Well, there was. Well, yes, there was a lot of responsibility when I look back on it. And people these days often say, gee, you blokes were only 21 years old. It was really a responsibility, which... But we didn't feel that it was that... much of a responsibility, but I was a bit apprehensive as to what the crew would think. But fortunately for me, one of the first landings I did with the crew was about the best landing I ever did, and I was very pleased about that, because it was really lucky. There was usually a bit of a bump, you know, even today when you come down in a jet, there's a bit of a bump. And but this time I was just holding off above the ground, and all of a sudden I heard the wheels rumble on the runway, and someone in the crew said, "Great landing, skipper." So that gave me a bit of confidence then. But they soon got to... thinking back, I think it would have been quite frightening to be a member of the crew at the beginning.
Why?
Oh, well, you didn't have any control over the darn aeroplane yourself, and you just had to get in and fly with whoever was allotted to you and whatnot. And in an emergency, at least the pilot was the one that could try and do something about it. The others just had to sit there and hope to God it all worked out. Anyway, we didn't get into any trouble at that stage, so...